Good afternoon. I'm Callie Crossley, and this is the Callie Crossley Show. Today, we're continuing our election coverage as part of GBH's 2010 Mass Decision coverage with another installment of Ask the Manager. We've been checking in with the managers who are running the candidates' campaign for the governor's race. Today, we're joined by Tim O'Brien, the brains and brawn behind Charlie Baker's campaign. Tim O'Brien, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, now's your chance to ask the manager. If you have questions about Charlie Baker's campaign, his policies on the economy, jobs, education, and health care, give us a call at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. So, Tim, we'd like to start these conversations with, who are you? So why this job?
Oh, obviously I'm the brains and brawn behind the Charlie Baker campaign. You said it.
Why do you take this job?
I have no idea. I have no idea. My wife, if it was up to her, I would not be in this position. You know, I've known Charlie for you know, a couple of years now. I most recently was at business school over at Babson College, getting my MBA, and just really thought that it was the right time and to help Charlie to the corner office that Massachusetts is facing incredibly difficult challenges. We're at the crossroads, and whether we're gonna create jobs or continue to lose them, whether we're gonna cut spending, reform government, or continue down the same road that we have been doing. And when he asked me to join his campaign, I was flattered, and it seemed like the right thing to do.
Well, you guys have a business connection, so were you always a political junkie, or this just came
as Yeah, no, I've been involved in politics. I went to school down in Washington, D.C., and worked for a pollster, worked for two congressmen, one a Democrat and one a Republican. While I was in school, went on to work for a pollster, a polling and consulting firm, was an assistant chief of staff for Governor Cellucci, worked for Governor Swift. Governor Romney was the head of the Republican Party in Massachusetts, worked on Governor Romney's presidential campaign as well as Carrie Healey's gubernatorial race. So I've always been interested in politics. It's a fascinating field. I've always tried to get out of it and go back and sort of to the real world. I thought this was my clean break, but I've decided to give it one more run here with Charlie.
Now, you came in the middle of this. He started with another campaign manager, right, then switched to you. How was that? Have you ever had to do that before?
No. Well, I was with Charlie from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. I headed up his convention effort, have been part of his campaign since the early days. So the transition was easy. It's always challenging when you're coming into someone else's organization. You know, there was a certain cultural or certain way of doing things. I think they had to get used to me, and I had to get used to them. But you know, campaigns are they're unlike businesses that they end. You know, we know when this is going to end. It's going to end on the first week of November. So we kind of had to get used to each other quickly, but, you know, stay focused on the overall goal, which was getting Charlie Baker elected governor.
Was that an easier thing? I know that was an impact on the campaign, but has it made a difference in the kind of strategy that you put forth?
No, it's always easier when you're starting your own, when you're starting your own organization. But the strategy for this is you know, you know, one thing I try to do is just simplify. This is very simple. It's a very, very simple race. You either think that the state's heading in the right direction or you think it's not. And if you think it's not heading in the direction, there's only one person in this race, Charlie Baker. They work on Beacon Hill. Charlie doesn't. Charlie wants to cut taxes and spending. They don't. You know, it's not one of these races. There was a Gallup poll over the weekend that said 65% of voters think that that the jobs and the economy are the number one issue. 65%. Everything else was under 7. Voters, they only care about one thing right now. And when you sort of look through the prism of that's what this race is about, it provides tremendous clarity. And it allows you as a campaign, a lot of times campaigns, they get distracted by this and that. Hey, we have to be talking about issue X and we have to be talking issue Y. And I think when you have when you have a young staff or you have an inexperienced campaign would allow you to sort of be taken in these different directions. You know, Karl Rove always used to say, you're sort of on a wall, you write down the ideal campaign. What's the ideal campaign? If we were to sort of sit here and say, what do we want to be talking? Well, and usually you have to sort of balance these different challenges and pulls and so on and so forth. This is very simple. We need to get Massachusetts working again. We've got a candidate that turned around, took a company from the brink of bankruptcy and turned it around. Well, what else do we think needs turning around right now? Massachusetts. He's the only guy who's going to do it. They work on Beacon Hill. He doesn't. He's got plans. They don't. And when you sort of instill that discipline and you look through the campaign and that through that lens, it's very easy. You know, and you just sort of let the candidate be the candidate. You let him sort of showcase his strengths, his vision. And what you try to do as a campaign manager is keep the organization very focused and not allow them to be distracted, because it's easy to be distracted in this business.
Okay. Listeners, you want to ask Tim O'Brien a question? Charlie Baker's campaign manager, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Okay. I'd be remiss if I didn't say there are four people in this campaign.
Right.
In this race. That's Jill Stein and Tim Cahill. You said there's only one other guy.
Right.
But I just want to make that clear for
sure.
All of our listeners that we're aware. I know from your purposes, there's only one other person you've trained your sights on, and that's Deval Patrick.
Well, no, I mean, we're interested in telling the voters why Charlie Baker is the right candidate. I think it's safe to say that either Tim Cahill either Deval Patrick or Charlie Baker will be the next governor. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's if anybody's looking at this race objectively, either one of those guys are going to be. I mean, you go poll, you know, 10 of the sort of wise guys, political watchers. And our first challenge is to sort of explain, you know, Charlie entered this race with zero name ID. Literally,
right.
We did a poll, you know, 1% of people knew who he was. And everybody's like, you know, why are you leading in the polls? Why? Well, you took a candidate who's never run for office, who isn't a politician. And you know, we slowly tried to establish why Charlie Baker's the right candidate. You know, now Charlie has, you know, 45% of the people who know who he is. He has, you know, 65,000 Facebook followers. You know, campaigns are this sort of long journey, and you create a narrative. You try to write a narrative, and we're in the process of doing that. But there's still a lot of people who need to sort of – who don't know who Charlie is, and they will.
What's the biggest advantage that your campaign has, you think?
Our biggest advantage is the candidate. I mean, our biggest advantage is we have a candidate who, you know, understands the challenges of trying to turn around an organization. We have a candidate who's not in office. Listen, you don't want to be in office right now. People want new. They want a new direction. It's hard to imagine you're going to get a new direction by either rehiring or promoting someone that's already up there. Mm-hmm. And we've got a candidate that sort of knows what to do. So I think the candidate certainly is a strength. I think the environment's a strength.
What's the disadvantage then?
We have 60% of the voters don't know who Charlie Baker is.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem, which we need to continue to define. We also have 60% of people don't know who Charlie Baker is. That's a great thing, because that means we have, you know, you look at these polls and say, well, you know, Deval Patrick has a hard stop at 40, 42, 43. It's not as if people are still trying to figure out who he is. That's where he's at. Charlie Baker's got all this room for growth. And the more people learn and understand about who Charlie is and what he wants to do and what he's willing to do that these other two guys aren't, we're going to be in a great position.
Okay, we got a caller. Jacob from Medford. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I just have a quick question. Since you're talking about cutting taxes, what programs would get cut as a result of that? We're already facing a budget crunch.
Oh, we are facing a huge budget crunch. And most people say that next year's budget deficit will be at right around between $2.5 to $3 billion. And unfortunately, the folks on Beacon Hill have decided to spend about $1.8 billion of our $2.5 billion rainy day fund, which means we only have about $600 or $700 million left, and we have a $2.5 billion problem. Charlie Baker has put forward, again, he's the only candidate in this race who has put forward 13 ideas to save the Commonwealth over $1 billion, and they range from PLAs, eliminating the Pacheco Law, all things that Beacon Hill does that cost us more as a state, because they're unwilling to stand up to the special interests and the other folks that just don't want to sort of institute the changes that we need. We're going to have to cut. Charlie Baker said we need to eliminate 5,000 jobs. We're going to have to reform, which he's put forward a series of reforms that will save the state real money. And we're going to have to face some short-term pains in order to get us in a position the state in a position to be back on a fiscal sort of strong fiscal footing. But make no mistake about this. This campaign, Massachusetts was ranked 40th out of 50 states in the cost of doing business. We're losing jobs. Companies are leaving Massachusetts and going to other states. If we don't get serious about creating an environment where people want to live, work, and bring business here, next year is the tip of the iceberg. We are going to have problems for years and years to come. We need to cut the cost of doing business, and we need to get real about creating jobs.
Okay, here's another caller. Dennis, go ahead, please.
Yes. your guest has talked about Charlie turning around Harvard Pilgrim. Well, when he did that, what he did was cut a lot of people and raised revenues by raising premiums 150%. He's talking about cutting state government and cutting revenues by cutting taxes. How's he going to come up with a balanced budget and turn the state around if he's going to cut revenues? And none of his proposals have given anything close to what he's talking about, even in cutting in taxes.
Well, no, I'd actually disagree. I think his proposals he's put forward actually are real dollars and will help us sort of bridge the gap. But let's go back to your sort of basic premise here with Charlie Baker when he took over Harvard Pilgrim. Harvard Pilgrim was on the brink of bankruptcy. Charlie Baker went in to fix it. Did he have to eliminate certain positions? Absolutely. Were there tough, hard choices that he had to make to turn Harvard Pilgrim around? Yes, you can't take a company that's mismanaged for over 10 years and expect to turn it around by continuing the status quo. And that's the problem we have on Beacon Hill right now. We have a bunch of people who think that we can sort of get Massachusetts heading in the right direction without making tough decisions. Massachusetts is facing huge, huge problems next year. And we just can't, you know, nibble at the edges. We're going to have to make real structural changes,
and it might be painful.
It's going to be painful, of course. Mm-hmm. But that's what we're living in. That's mm-hmm. the world we're living in, mm-hmm. and we can either sort of kick the can down the road and say, "Well, you know, we got to sort of do this and this," or we're going to say, "Listen, this is a time and a chance for us to sort of look inward and say we need to do more with less. Companies are doing more than less. We need to, someone could be collecting services from the state of Massachusetts, and they could have multiple entry points." And they deal with maybe public health or other different agencies. Why do we do that? Why don't they have one point of entry that then coordinates all the different needs that they have, right? That seems like it would make sense to do from an organizational standpoint. Well, we don't want to do that because you may have to eliminate jobs. But these are the types of efficiencies that Charlie's willing to explore. The status quo right now is, well, listen, we're just going to continue to raise taxes. We're spending $3 billion now than we were spending 4 years ago at a time when everybody else, whether it's their family budget or companies, are spending less. We haven't gotten serious at all about the cost of government, reforming government, making it cheaper, making it more effective. And what's it mean is we're raising taxes, more and more taxes, and we're driving companies up. That is a death spiral.
Okay.
And we can either sit here and say, let's continue to do that, or we can say, let's get serious about creating jobs. Let's get serious about what this state's going to look like. Because if we don't change it, we're in real, real trouble.
Okay, so Tim, let's just say that everybody that who is supportive of Charlie Baker and the work that he did at Harvard Pilgrim says that's a positive thing. Well, one of the negative things, of course, is the Big Dig, where they, that was an inflated job situation.
Sure.
There were lots of folks can tell you some jobs needed to have been cut there. There were some painful decisions that should have been made, and yet your candidate is very much identified with that, and that's considered a downer for a lot of people.
Sure.
A big mistake. How do you
respond to that? Well, sure. I don't think you want to be associated with it. I mean, I think our opponents have been very effective in their attacks and misrepresentations of Charlie Baker's role in the Big Dig. Charlie Baker, the Big Dig went on for 20-some-odd years. Charlie Baker was there for four of it. This thing was started in the Reagan administration. Ted Kennedy, Tip O'Neill started this organization. Don't quote me on this, but something like, $18 billion.
It wasn't all his fault, is your point.
$18 billion was already spent before he got there.
Okay.
I mean, so what was he going to do? Was he going to sort of leave a hole in the middle of the ground? So he came up with a financing plan that Deval Patrick is using today to bridge a gap. Now they're going to want to talk about the Big Dig. They're going to want to talk about a role he had in administration 20 years ago. I think most people, most voters in Massachusetts are going to look at that and say, you're going to talk about a role someone had, a small role, someone had 20. I think most voters in Massachusetts are going to say, that's important, but I'm more concerned about who's going to create jobs. I'm more concerned about who's going to sort of cut taxes. I'm more concerned about someone who's actually going to go to Beacon Hill and change it. You know, Deval Patrick likes to say he's changed Beacon Hill. If you think that the Beacon Hill has been changed, you ought to vote for Deval Patrick. We're not your guy. If you think the Beacon Hill looks awful similar to the Beacon Hill of 4 years ago, then your person is Charlie Baker, because he thinks that we have a million things we ought to be doing.
Okay.
And I think at the end of the day, there are a bunch of folks that are going to sort of sit here and say that's going to be an issue for them. I think the vast majority is going to say, I'm not really concerned about that. And our opponents, I don't blame our Democratic, our opponents. I expect them to continue to misrepresent his role. But that's because they don't want to talk about the last 4 years. And I don't blame them, because it's been a complete disaster.
Okay, I've been asking all of the managers who've come here if they would share some insight that says something about the person, maybe personally, that we don't know, that gives some insight as to, you know, who the candidate is.
And Charlie Baker is, and there's a bunch of these stories. Charlie Baker is one of the most thoughtful, considerate persons I've ever been around. You know, when he was at Harvard, he tells this story. He wrote down a Big Brother. You know, he saw a Big Brother ad and wrote down the phone number. And he looked at it for about a month every time he would sort of do his homework. He decided to reach out to this individual. And that little brother lived in his dorm room for close to 4 years. I think the Globe did spotlight on it, took care of that person. There was a story in Michigan of an individual that was having trouble with some authorities. Charlie Baker wrote him a check from an article in the news magazine. Guy wrote him a thank you letter back. They started talking. Found out the guy was trying to get a job, was on welfare, but needed a car because he couldn't get to his job. Charlie Baker took his car, drove it out to Michigan. Didn't know who the person was. Didn't know what he needed. Didn't know how he was going to use it, but thought he needed it. He needed it because he was trying to better his life. Charlie Baker drove it out there, gave him the keys, and flew back because Charlie Baker's concerned about people and about improving their lives. And that's why I sat next to him and said, Charlie, why'd you get in this race? Because people are hurting, and what is going on in Beacon Hill isn't going to help their lives. If we're really going to turn around people's lives, we need to start in Beacon Hill.
All right. Well, you heard it here. That's an endorsement for Charlie Baker from his campaign manager, Tim O'Brien. Tim O'Brien, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, lovely time. Thank you.
Coming up, it's Alexander Pryor, the composer and conductor who is a fellow this summer at the Tanglewood Music Center. We'll be back after this break. Stay with us.
Support for WGBH comes from you. And from Elsa Dorfman, Cambridge portrait photographer, still clicking with a jumbo format Polaroid 20x24 analog camera and original Polaroid film, online at elsadorfman.com. That's elsadorfman.com. And from Somerset Subaru, recipient of the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety Award for all 2010 models. Somerset Subaru, here for you, here for life. Route 195 or somersetautogroup.com.
Listener-supported WGBH brings you all kinds of perspectives, from international...
The narrow stone streets of Lamu have reverberated with the Islamic call to prayer for 1,000 years.
To local.
The troublemakers, it's not every kid in Dorchester.
I know.
It's a very small group of kids.
To personal.
Rebecca didn't know any of this until the first letter, to a daughter reeling from the loss of her mother. It was the ultimate birthday present.
Your support helps 89.7 connect your community with the world.
Almost a third of American children are overweight. Almost a quarter of American children live in families without enough to eat. How can both those statements be true?
A gallon of milk is $3 something. A bottle of orange soda is 89 cents. Do the math.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, Poor Children and Poor Nutrition, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
News, music, and culture from around the world and from your own backyard. There's lots more to come, so keep listening. Listener support means that 89.7 WGBH is your radio station.
I'm Callie Crossley, and this is the Callie Crossley Show. You're listening to Vilitslavitsa, which is perhaps my guest Alexander Pryor's most famous composition. It was commissioned by Channel 4 as part of the World's Greatest Musical Prodigies TV series. Alexander Pryor, at the age of 17, has a long list of accomplishments. He just finished his run as assistant to the guest conductor for the Seattle Symphony Orchestra. He started piano at age 3, he's been composing since age 8, and at 13 he picked up the conductor's baton, and he's been on the podium ever since. Last year he was host of the British TV series The World's Greatest Musical Prodigies, and he joins us today in our studio because this summer he's a Tanglewood Music Center conducting fellow. Alexander Pryor, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, how exciting it is to meet you. Your work is so beautiful.
Thank you.
tell us what you're doing at Tanglewood.
Oh, well, I'm a conducting fellow at Tanglewood, and that's very exciting. So we do performances and whatnot. But what the most exciting thing is, of course, is that we get to work with really some amazing musicians. Just yesterday, Maestro Michael Tilson Thomas left, so we were working with him for over a week, who is just... I've known him for a little bit longer than just here, but I've always been huge admirer, and that was an amazing experience for me. And then we had Maestro Frubik de Burgos, and now we're going to have Maestro Blumstead, and then Robert Spano, who I greatly admire, and now we have Von Dohnányi, and the list just goes on and on and on and on, and it's quite amazing. And to learn from these people, and to be in such a magical place, you know, a place which has
beautiful.
Such spirit, yeah. Beautiful, yes, but also with the sort of that aura, that history in it of so many great, I guess, predecessors of ours.
Well, you just ran down the list of course, renowned composers and conductors. And, you know, some would add your name to that list because you've got 40 compositions now.
Oh, well, no, that's 40 is a very bizarre number. It's one which has been around for about 5 years. It's somewhere in my biography it's got stuck. I don't know how many pieces I have, maybe less, maybe more. Depends what you call a piece. So I've recently been sort of saying, right, that isn't. Yeah, I think also that composing and conducting are a very good combination. They help, one helps each other, the other. And it's very nice here in Tanglewood that you there's so much different music.
How do they help one another?
Oh, well, first of all, it help, as a conductor, you understand the orchestra in more detail. Just practical things, emotional things, what works, what doesn't, what makes the orchestra excited, what doesn't. Because if the orchestra's excited, they're going to create a sound which makes the audience more excited. So the whole thing, so that from that point of view, as a composer, you understand how a composer structures things, how one makes it. Which means as a conductor, the biggest thing we do, the most important thing we do, and Michael is very strict about this, is that we structure. We create the bigger arc. Yes, we do little details, but it's the bigger arc which really matters. And that really helps you when you're a composer to do that.
All of this started when you were 12, for goodness sake, and you're just now 17. So a lot of people are breathless with wonder about someone with the kind of talent that you possess at this quite young age. How do you feel that about yourself? Do you see yourself as a prodigy?
No, I detest that word. I find it a negative word because a prodigy, at least in my sort of vocab, it's someone who has great talent and great potential, but not necessarily has developed that potential. Now, I think that I loved doing the program.
The World's Greatest Musical Prodigies. Yes,
I was. We were all against the title because I didn't think they were prodigies. I think they were great young musicians. That was the only problem I had with it. Otherwise, I loved it. It was great meeting these young, fantastic musicians. But so prodigy isn't the word. But of course, the whole age thing gets mentioned now and then for obvious reasons. And I'm not too keen on it, but on the other hand, I'm not going to have it forever, am I? So it'll disappear gradually. I'll be 18 soon, and then I'll be 30 and 50, and soon I'll be old. And
oh yeah, right, really old.
80 and 100. I don't know. I enjoy the fact, particularly as a composer, the way I see the world now, I'm sure will be very different in 5, 10, 20 years. So I really try to capture the way I see the world now in my music.
Well, I want to give our listeners a chance to hear a little bit more of your music. Now, you were 14 years old when you first conducted the ballet that you composed for the Moscow Classical State Ballet. Mm-hmm. And here's the finale of the ballet, which is called Mowgli and based on the Jungle Book by Rudyard Kipling. Okay. Now, I have to say that to me sounds so young and bright that it I relate to it.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that was, actually.
Oh, really?
That seemed to be a bit of a mishap.
Oh, sorry. That's not Mowgli?
No.
Okay, well, tell me what it is.
I'm not sure what it is.
All right, well, we have it mislabeled.
I can tell you about Mowgli.
Okay, please. Yeah.
That was a wonderful project. I was approached by, or actually I sent out my first ballet. I wrote a little one-act ballet called Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, and I'm sure many are familiar with the Middle English poem based on the King Arthur legend. Mm. And I sent it to them, and they said, yes, we love your music. Natalia Kasatkin and Lenina Vasilyov, who are the choreographers of this, but they said, we've always, always dreamed of putting on Mowgli. Mm. And can we please do Mowgli? So I said, well, of course. And we involved choir, and it was this huge, big thing, and it's still on, and it was the most amazing experience of my life. I was 13, and here I was in this full theatrical world. And
wow.
And since then, I've been very keen on writing for theatre.
Well, I think that's great. Okay, now, daggone it, we're going to get some of your, make sure that we have the right thing. How about this? Here's a piece called Horizons. This is an American crescendo, premiered this past April, and this piece is dedicated to the American president.
No, to an American composer.
American composer, John Adams. All right, we'll get it. This is so big to me. This seems big, you know, just as a person who just enjoys the music. And I think to myself, how can someone quite, you know, so young come up with something so large and wonderful? Well, it was exciting music.
Oh, thank you.
Me.
Well, that's the very beginning. And it's a short 8-minute piece. And it's, I guess I'm very fond of this country and of the nature of this country and of nature is in the physical nature and also of the principles and things that it stands for. So this piece was very much my homage, I guess, homage to the land, and also to John Adams, who is really my hero as a composer. Mm. And it was for these same four young soloists who are in the Vidislavitsa, with which we started the Channel 4 project. I was doing a repeat concert of this with the Royal Philharmonic, which is who you heard playing, and these four wonderful young soloists. And so I wrote. It was this. It's a bizarre concept. I gave it this sort of wacky name, Horizons ; an American crescendo for four soloists and rather large orchestra. So John Adams likes doing those sorts of titles, and I thought, why not just go for wackiness? Since a lot of my pieces are all dramatic, dark forests and big epic stories, why not have something slightly more humorous? And it's not humorous, but it's light in places, and it's happy and optimistic, and I kind of like doing that sort of music more and more.
You know, I have to say that when I first read anything about you, I immediately came to mind. What came to mind is Gustavo Dudamel, who's the Venezuelan conductor, who's quite young when he started and is now conducting.
Still quite young.
Why he is. Yeah. But I'm just saying, young as you are now, but he's conducting the Los Angeles Philharmonic now. And that's what came to mind. And you've said in some of your other interviews that it seems that people in America seem to embrace the youth aspect a little bit better than folks in Britain.
Oh,
why
yeah.
is that?
I think there's a very much a culture. American music making and cultural traditions in general are very different from European ones, which is fantastic to know. I guess the grass is always green on the other side. But there is particularly in America, there is a love for young musicians. I don't necessarily mean young as in teenagers, but generally on the younger side, as well, of course, as huge respect for the great maestros and performers who we have. And that's great to have that balance. I don't know why it is. I think it's just a celebration of excellence that America generally has. And that's why America has succeeded so well, particularly culturally, in the last sort of 50 years.
You don't think it's just because we're obsessed with youth here? Maybe a little bit.
It might be a little bit, but I tend to look at things with slightly sort of, you know, pink shaded glasses. I look at the best side of things, and Britain. I don't want to criticize too much because it does many great things and with young people too. But that particular tradition of particularly sort of emphasizing excellence of youth isn't so it's more of a teamwork thing there. There's a great tradition of youth orchestras and whatnot, and but it's not quite such a thing. That said, there are things coming up now which are positions for under 25 conductors, under 25, under 23, which is great. I think that it's swinging around to that, particularly as they just literally announced. Because unlike America, European orchestras, particularly British ones, are government-sponsored.
Right.
Completely opposite to American orchestras, so fully government-sponsored. And they're cutting it by 30-40%. So they really have to switch somewhat to the American way of looking for donors and funding, private funding. And that, I think, people who are donors and private funders enjoy young artists.
I want to be clear to our listeners, to be clear that, you know, being a prodigy doesn't mean that you just sort of woke up one day and figured it's all out, that you've been studying very hard and just completed 4 years of study at the St. Petersburg Conservatory. Mm-hmm. So this is really hard work.
Oh, it was very hard work. It was worth it. I can tell you that. It was worth it.
I want to know if young people, do you think, will embrace the kind of music and your enthusiasm about it because you are young. Have you seen that people get excited, young people get excited?
Oh, yes. I had the most amazing experience in two particularly amazing experiences. I do a lot with young people, but one was in Newcastle in England in the northeast, with which the Willis-Levitz was recorded, that orchestra, the Northern Symphonia, and they re-invited me, and we were doing a program, which is a very nice program, but not one I would expect young people to come to. Sibelius, Kollema and Valstrist, Elgar, String Serenade, etc. Sort of quite conservative programming, very beautiful programming, and there was this horde of young people, which was fantastic. Young from about the age of 14 to about 25, which is exactly the age range you don't expect in a concert hall, because little children go with their parents. But these sort of age, and I was overwhelmed. And afterwards, I was doing a CD signing, and it was just amazing. These young people coming up saying, "Well, we've never been to a classical concert, but now we're going to keep going because it's so exciting and so fun." And it is. Classical music does bring the best out of people. And then I did the same thing in Seattle. I did this was a young people's concert. It was Peter and the Wolf, so it was kind of sort of up to the age of 13, 14.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing. These kids, they're the hardest audience, because if they don't like it, they will scream, they will be bored, and they will start talking. If they like it, however, they're also the most rewarding audience, because they will be really grateful if they had fun. It's really moving to do those sorts of things. And people always complain that, oh, well, very few young people are listening to classical music now. Oh, culture is dying. Actually, throughout the history of all of time, classical music has always been the very little. I mean, Mozart wasn't exactly a classical composer. Mm. In his own day, he was writing the popular music of his time. Other composers were writing the more. So actually, I think in 50 years, this whole border of classical music and pop music will die out, and we'll just be left with good music and bad music. Or we won't have the bad music, we'll just remember the good music. And that's a wonderful thought. And it's very, of course, encouraging in Tanglewood to see all these young musicians who are a little bit older than me, but they're all very young, just so dedicated to their art, so with such huge love and passion for their art. You know, it's a sign that classical music and civilization, which is basically a reflection of art and culture of our time, is going to live on. And it might go through ups and downs, but it's going to live on.
What kind of music do you listen to other than classical?
I'm a great lover of folk music. Mm. I listen to a lot of Norwegian folk music and Russian folk music and generally Scandinavian folk music, Nordic folk music, Celtic folk music, sometimes southwestern French folk music. Then bluegrass and Appalachian fiddling, which is also folk music, Native American folk music.
What does music mean to you?
What does music mean to me? Music, I think, it's the most amazing art because it's the most abstract. In words, we can say, well, this, he went there and she did this and he killed him and she loved him. And in paintings, we can picture this. Music doesn't necessarily say anything, but it can also say everything. And music has the ability to both be the most boring of arts and to be the most exciting. And if you get it right, music can open to yourself. I'm not even talking about affecting your audiences, which is a whole nother exciting thing. But just to me, as a composer, writing my music, I can explore sides of me which I could never find in life. It really opens your soul out, and it makes you a better person. And I think of everything in music. Everything is music. I think of a tree, of a person, everything. I hear music to it. I don't actually know how people live without beautiful music. I look at people who are or see people who with whom music isn't involved in their everyday life, and I think, wow, how do you do that? I'm amazed because it seems to be such an amazing thing to have, and life would seems to be, without it would be so boring.
I think you're the greatest ambassador for your art.
I try to advocate because people will be so much happier with music. Honestly, I'd write down people a list of pieces to listen to, and their life becomes better from it. You know, just from listening to music and exploring it. Pop music, you see, on the whole, popular music, with exceptions, doesn't require thought. You just sort of sit back and you go. Classical music, you have to really think through every note. Every note has a meaning. So it's harder to listen to classical music. It's not relaxing necessarily, but it is bettering.
Where are you in 5 years?
Oh, I don't know where I'll be. It's very hard as a conductor, particularly, less so as a composer. As a conductor, you're moving around so much. And, you know, as young conductors, we basically look for several things. We look for guest engagements and we look for positions, either assistant positions with big orchestras, you know, like the Chicago or Boston or Philharmonia or whatnot, or you look for a music directorship of perhaps a slightly smaller orchestra. But that's practical. I like to think of myself, because it's so hard to say where you will be in 5 years, I say this. I want to make sure every rehearsal, every concert I do is the best one I've ever done. Every piece I write is better than the previous one, basically to improve and thus be working with better and better ensembles and soloists and whatnot and bringing music to more and more people. But that's where I want to be in 5 years. I want to be 5 years better than I am now. And I want to be like that forever.
Okay, we've been speaking with Alexander Pryor, and I'm telling you that's a name that you heard it here first, and it won't be the last time you've heard it. He's a conductor and composer. Among his endless accomplishments, he's also a Tanglewood Music Center Fellow. This Sunday, he'll be conducting the Tanglewood Music Center Orchestra in Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet at 8 p.m. in Ozawa Hall. Alexander Pryor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Coming up, it's our regular Monday feature, Local Made Good. We'll meet the artist and the engineer behind the restoration of the sound sculpture at the Kendall Square Tea Stop. We'll be back after this break. Stay with us.
Support for WGBH comes from you and from Newbury Court, overlooking the Sudbury River in Concord, Mass., a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. You can learn more at newburycourt.org, a Deaconess Abundant Life community. And from the Newport Music Festival, celebrating their 42nd season of music in the Newport Mansions, July 9th through the 25th. For more information or to buy tickets, you can visit newportmusic.org.
You're listening to 89.7 WGBH,
Boston's NPR station for news, context, and analysis.
With Morning Edition,
The Takeaway,
and The Diane Rehm Show.
Explore ideas with us
all day long
here on the new 89.7 WGBH.
.7 WGBH Radio makes you do more than listen. It makes you think about things in a whole new way. It introduces you to people on the other side of the world. It makes you understand different ideas a little better than you did before. It makes you laugh and dance and sing and cry and think. Listener supported 89.7 WGBH is for people who do more than just listen.
Why 89.7?
Because
the way some Kenyans run, that is barefoot, may be better for their bodies than running in shoes.
Because you'll only hear Marco Werman and the World on the new 89.7 WGBH Radio.
I'm Callie Crossley, and this is the Callie Crossley Show. It's time for our regular Monday feature, Local Made Good, where we celebrate people whose creativity and individuality bring honor to New England. My guest today is Paul Matisse. Paul Matisse is a local artist and inventor. He is also the grandson of Henri Matisse. I'm also joined by Michael Tarkanian. He is a technical instructor in MIT's Department of Materials, Science, and Engineering. And they are both here today to discuss the Kendall Band, which, for those of you who haven't Pop the Tea by Way of the Kendall Square Tea Stop is a huge interactive sound sculpture which was designed by Paul Matisse. Michael Tarkanian is leading the charge to restore it. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
I have to start with you, Paul Matisse, and ask you, how did you get the idea for this sculpture? I've been there. I've looked at it. It's lovely, even when it's not operating right now.
Well, the idea really came from long time ago when I was in a countryside wandering through the woods, and I found a concrete abutment in the ground with posts sticking out of it. And I assumed this was in Europe, that this was an old anti-aircraft setting. And I sat there waiting for the ferry, throwing stones from where I sat at these solid, big posts, threaded posts, you know, that were coming out of the concrete. Because every time I ticked one, it made this beautiful sound. And the sound was, this was in the summertime, this was in Greece, this was with birds and other sounds, but it was absolutely beautiful. It always stayed with me. I never made anything out of it in terms of a piece, but it was after making the musical fence for Cambridge that I saw them or was asked to compete. And at that point, I thought, it's got to be sound, because here is a resonant chamber. The sound, if we had beautiful sound in here, we would have a wonderful time. Just like when you go to a concert in a cathedral in Europe, it resonates. It's just marvelous.
Well, there are three pieces to the Kendall band. One is 16 tubes and 14 mallets called Pythagoras, okay. Right. Then there's Kepler, and that's Kepler. A hammer and a ring.
Right.
And then there's Galileo, yeah. Which is a metal sheet. Yeah. It's kind of a big metal sheet.
Right.
And as you walk down in the tea stop, you can see all three pieces of it.
Right.
Now, since it's almost from the moment that it went up some 20 years ago, you've just had a time trying to keep it going, kind of keep it repaired so that people could turn the handle and hear the music that it's supposed to play.
Yeah, yeah, this is true. And it was not that I planned it that way. But let me just say that here's Pythagoras. Mm-hmm. The reason that he's called Pythagoras, first of all, it's MIT station,
right.
Associated with MIT, which is a place I did not go to, probably should have gone to, but then would have missed a whole lot of other things. In any case, I thought naturally of the big names of science, and Pythagoras came first because when I first started making one of the bells, the first bell, it didn't work. That is to say, this beautiful sound that I was sure was going to come out of the bell did not. It was not a nice sound at all. I wouldn't have put 16 of those things up for anything. And so I had to go back to my my books. I dug out my Physics 101.
And figured it out.
book to find out what was going on, why this sound wasn't so beautiful. And so it was Pythagoras that I had to go down to or back to. And so after doing him, and then I had this other idea that 16 bells would not be enough for a really nice piece, I decided to make the big center ring. And I called that Kepler because actually the center ring is not a perfect circle. It should have been. I mean, I said it was going to be a perfect circle to myself. But as it turned out, it has a slight oval quality.
Which actually I like.
And Kepler was, of course, the man who kept thinking that God would make all the planets go around in perfect circles because God was perfect. And it was after years of failing to make his equations work that he finally tried the equations for an ellipse. And bingo.
There you go.
And so that was that. Then Galileo, the last one, the big thunder sheet, was simply to recognize Galileo for the noises that were going to come out of science from then on.
Beautiful background for that. Now, for those people who have not seen the Kendall band, and they're You know, we've just discussed what it's made up of. If you can pull a handle, you can make it go. We found an example of it on YouTube. So you're going to hear some voices of people in it, but you'll also hear the music. So here we go. I say, so you get the idea of how beautiful it was. And Michael Tarkanian, that's why you're here, because that sound's been silent in the T-square because it's been broken. And you guys over at MIT have taken it upon yourself, calling yourselves the Kindle Band Preservation Society, to get this up and rolling again.
Right. There was a lot of interest over the years that was kind of brewing at MIT in making these things work and kind of taking over their long-term care. But nothing really got rolling until the last year when a community member emailed the music department at MIT about saying, why can't MIT fix these things? That email went to Clarice Snyder, who works in the music department, and she thought, well, that's a good idea. And she started looking for someone to help with the technical aspects, and I believe started communicating with Paul at that point. And she sent out an email to everyone that was related to music classes, and people kept forwarding me the email saying, this is the project for you, this is the project for you. And I had read an article in the Globe, I think in 2007, mm-hmm. that was about Paul's struggles to keep this running. And I thought back then that, boy, that would be a fun project to work on.
So, and now you've got students working with you.
Right. So part of my job at MIT in the material science department is to get students involved with hands-on projects and kind of teach them traditional engineering skills, prototyping, building, those type of activities. So I thought, oh, this is a perfect fit to get students involved in our department and in the general MIT community with a hands-on project like this.
I think all of this is interactive. The restoration project that you're engaged in, and then Paul, your whole point was that it should be interactive. And it seems to me that this sculpture was in place before the interactive generation, if you will. We're now there.
I'm even part of not that the interactive generation, because at one point when in one of my first inventions, a Calyroscope, people like to come and touch it because the heat of their hands would make it work. But I had heaters inside it to make the designs that I wanted it to make. And I rejected that sort of interactivity. But after a little while and seeing the enthusiasm and the electric connection when somebody touches
engages.
And does something,
yes.
I gave in completely and feel that there are artworks which need to be just purely the artist, and there are other artworks which can be touched and handled and so forth.
One of the things that I've enjoyed hearing about is that as you were repairing it during the years yourself, Paul, and you've put a little note up and said, I'm working on it, people would write notes to you. Same thing has happened, Michael, now you and your crew of MIT students. Share one of the notes that people wrote, Paul, to you, just saying,
well,
keep going.
There are hundreds and hundreds of comments that are now on a DVD that I've got where I have you can see these images are, this was the original note, and these are the comments on it. But one of the comments I wanted to read is this card that I got from a student in Germany. Mm-hmm. He says, Dear Mr. Matisse, this was 11/20/87. I came here to Boston this first day when it started snowing, and I took the wrong train and changed at Kendall Station. It was late, and outside was the first snow falling, which made the whole atmosphere very quiet. With this mood, I entered the platform. I think I was the only one around, and somebody used the handle before he left. After the train left, I recognized the sound, and I was overwhelmed. Stood by step by step, it occurred to me that the whole thing with the walls and pictures was art. And I had joy and pleasure like when I was 10 years old. I felt very thankful to be able to hear sound, and I want to thank you for this.
Wonderful. Michael, so, your crew is also getting notes as they've seen you repairing it.
We are. There have been a lot of small notes, thank you, it's about time, things like that. The funny thing is it's been all on the outbound side, all on the inbound side.
Oh, that's
and
interesting.
Nothing, not a word on the outbound side. So do it's you, good, and the students have been thrilled to see that feedback.
Mm-hmm. Do you leave explanatory notes as to what you're doing?
We haven't yet. So mm-hmm. far, the notes have just been the instruments are undergoing
You, in fact, have taken the handles to your laboratory to work on them.
Right. So all six handles are down, and the notes basically said we're fixing the instruments. I think now, this weekend, actually, we're planning to take down Pythagoras. And I think at that point we'll need to put up a more explanatory note.
Well, I should alert our listeners that if you're interested in watching them from 1 to 4 a.m. on Sunday, July the 25th, they're going to be in the subway doing your work.
I don't think the public will be allowed in, but that's when we'll be there.
Well, if somebody's taking
because
the train.
The train stop. The train stop at 1 or 1:15 and so forth.
Okay, oh well.
And one of the most beautiful things that ever happened to me at that train station was when I was there early, before 1, and there was only one other person in the station, and he was standing on the opposite tracks, and he was very, very powerful as a person. He had a black leather jacket. He looked like he was truly out of sorts, a little bit angry underneath everything, and he was walking up and down the platform. And I was on the opposite side looking up at the pieces that I was thinking, now how am I going to fix that? And finally, he broke the silence and he looked at me and he said, "You Paul?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I don't know if anyone's ever said this to you, but I want to thank you for your work." And then the last train rolled in and took him away. And it was enormously moving because we were separated by a rail, two third rails, and by this mechanical space. And yet there was a connection there that I've treasured forever. And that has come through again and again, you know, like this. Every once, when I was just looking over this one, Paul, this is written right down the corner of the note. Paul, you've meant more to us than you'll ever know.
That's what I love about public art in its ability to, you know, be out there and to touch people. Mm. And Michael, I have to say the fact that, I mean, of course, Paul's artistry is there and that's fabulous. But if it weren't for you, you engineers in your own artistic way, we might not have this. And so I'm appreciative of the work that you're doing.
Thank you. We're honored to be able to do it and happy to help.
Do you feel like an artist in the way that Paul is when working on it?
No, not in the way that Paul is, but I think engineering is its own artistry in a way.
All righty.
I agree.
Well, we've been speaking with artist and inventor Paul Matisse and Michael Tarkanian. Paul Matisse is an artist and inventor, and Michael Tarkanian is a technical instructor in MIT's Department of Materials, Science, and Engineering. He's also leading the effort to restore the Kendall Band sound sculpture. They're doing it this weekend, but I'm wrong. You can't watch it, public. They're doing it from 1 to 4, and the trains will be stopped. I encourage everybody to go see it because it's wonderful. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
This is the Callie Crossley Show. Today's program was engineered by Alan Mattis and produced by Chelsea Murs, Anna White-Knuckleby, and Abby Ruzica. Our intern is Lakeisha Landrum. We are a production of WGBH Radio, Boston's NPR station for news and culture.
bugs.